Thank you, Amber. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. My name is Kent Wenger, and my pronouns are he, him, his. I've been a member here since 2013. I had actually looked that up. I didn't remember exactly what year. And the program committee thought that I might be sort of an appropriate presider today because 10 years ago, I traveled in Eastern Europe, not in Ukraine, but a bit in Bosnia and Herzegovina. So I saw the aftermath of the war there firsthand. And at that time, it was the largest war in Europe since the end of World War II. And unfortunately, I guess that's no longer the case. But anyhow, Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. We strive to be welcoming to all, although we recognize that we all have biases that limit our understanding of how others may perceive us and how we perceive others. We stumble in our efforts, but we commit to keep trying to grow our ability to love people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender identity, family structure, age, or abilities. All right, so there are a few announcements this morning. There will be rock painting for reproductive justice on Saturday, July 16th at 5 p.m. Join together with other members of the Prairie community to paint rocks, to share information and support reproductive rights. Folks can spread completed rocks throughout the wider community. This event combines crafting and activism. Please drop in anytime and stay as long as you wish. All ages welcome, though some folks may need help with fine motor skills. The Prairie Board of Trustees has changed members as of July 1st. Here's the list of the current members. President is Kathy Converse. Vice President is Lynn Curry, continuing from the previous term. Treasurer is Suzanne Gernant, also continuing. Secretary is Dan Proud, continuing. And trustees are Renee Deschard, Karen Deaton, and John Andre. And then there are other events and so on in the order of service. And then one further announcement is that the Prairie Guys Group will meet here on Thursday at 7 p.m. So basically a group for guys and friends of guys to discuss various issues and kind of get together informally and strengthen our connections. All right, so that's it for announcements. The opening music is Soon the Day Will Arrive, number 146 in the gray book here. Should be under the seat in front of you or somewhere else nearby. And please stand as you're able. Thank you. All right, thanks, Amber. And the chalice lighting will be read by Deesa Pence.
Hi, I'm Deesa Pence, she, her. My chalice lighting today is by Lisa Deggy. Why a flaming chalice? The question comes. It's the cup of life, we answer. A cup of blessings overflowing, a cup of water to quench our spirit's thirst, a cup of wine for celebration and dedication, the flame of truth, the fire of purification, oil for anointing, healing, out of chaos, fear, and horror, thus was created the symbol crafted a generation ago. So may it be for us in these days of uncertainty, sorrow, and rage, and a light to warm our souls and guide us home.
All right, it's now time for the story for all ages, The Day War Came by Nicola Davies, and Alice Mant is going to read that. So kids and kids at heart can come forward for the story reading. Oh, and after the story, we'll sing the children out. The lyrics are in the order of service. You need to steal.
Maybe I'll just, yeah. The day the war came. The day war came, there were flowers on the windowsill, and my father sang my baby brother back to sleep. My mother made breakfast, kissed my nose, and walked me to school. That morning, I learned about volcanoes. I sang a song about how tadpoles turn at last to frogs. I drew a picture of a bird. Then, just after lunch, war came. At first, just like a spattering of hail, a voice of thunder, then all smoke and fire and noise that I did not understand. It came across the playground. It came into my teacher's face. It brought the roof down and turned my town into rubble. I can't say the words that tell you about the blackened hole that had been my home. All I can say is this. War took everything. War took everyone. I was ragged, bloody, all alone. I ran, walked over fields and roads and mountains in the cold and mud and rain, rode on the backs of trucks, in buses, went on a boat that leaked and almost sank, then up a beach where shoes lay empty in the sand. I ran until I could not run. Until I reached a row of huts and found a corner with a dirty blanket and a door that rattled in the wind. But war had followed me. It was underneath my skin, behind my eyes, and in my dreams. It had taken possession of my heart. I walked and walked and tried to drive the war out of myself, to try and find a place it hadn't reached. But war was in the way that the doors shut when I came down the street. It was in the way that people didn't smile and turned away. I came to a school. I looked in through the window. They were learning all about volcanoes, singing and drawing birds. I went inside. My footsteps echoed in the hole. I pushed the door and faces turned towards me, but the teacher didn't smile. She said, "There's no room for you, you see. There's no chair for you to sit. You have to go away." And then I understood that war had got here too. I turned around and went back to the hut, the corner and the blanket, and crawled inside. It seemed that war had taken all the world and all the people in it. The door banged. I thought it was the wind, but a child's voice spoke. "I brought you this," he said, "so you can come to school." It was a chair for me to sit on and learn about volcanoes, sing and draw birds, and drive the war out of my heart. He smiled and said, "My friends have brought theirs too, so all the children here can come to school." And then I out of every hut, a child came, and we walked together on a road all lined with chairs, pushing back the war with every step. And that's the end.
We'll now have a short period of meditation, silent meditation. All right, so probably a good thing to have some meditation before today's presentation. Political scientist Yoshihiko Herrera will provide insight into the ongoing war in Ukraine. This talk is sponsored by Badger Talks, and this presentation relates to our sixth principle, the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. Professor Herrera, a political science professor at the UW, has written extensively on U.S.-Russian relations, nationalism, and xenophobia, and international politics. Before coming to the UW in 2007, Herrera studied at Dartmouth College and the University of Chicago, and she taught in the government, in the Department of Government at Harvard University for 8 years. Herrera is a former director of UW's Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia, CRECA, former co-director of the Institute for Regional and International Studies, and former director of the UW-Madison Partnership with Nazarbayev University in Kazakhstan. Outside of the classroom, she has also served as an expert on Russian tensions with the United States and NATO as a panelist and public speaker. Dr. Herrera.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm especially happy to be here because Prairie is the home of my good friend Aaron Bosch here, so it's really nice to have this opportunity, and it was just coincidental. I had thought Aaron had invited me, but it turns out it was just through Badger Talks. Next slide. I'm going to start with, I just wanted to start the talk with a map, with a couple of maps to give some context to the overall situation. Because I think the size of the territory of Ukraine is important for understanding a number of things about the war and the strategic goals of Russia in the war. So the first thing, in the upper left-hand corner, you can see that Ukraine is the largest country in Europe in terms of territorial size. Obviously much smaller than Russia, but bigger than other countries in Europe. If you transpose Ukraine on the United States, you see that it extends all the way from New York to Chicago. So it's really a massive territory. And so just from the start, the idea that Russia is going to invade Ukraine and take over the country in 3 days, you can see how fanciful that is just from a size perspective. That's a massive territory and seems kind of like a crazy thing to do. The other thing is, in the center map of Ukraine, you can see that there's a river that goes through the country, the Dnieper River. And that roughly divides Ukraine into what people would think of as the East and the West. In the Western side, there were more Ukrainian speakers, ethnic Ukrainians. And in the Eastern side, more Russian speakers and ethnic Russians. But as I'm going to talk about later, a lot of those ethnic and linguistic distinctions have changed pretty dramatically over time. But the river is still important because armies, people, et cetera, still need bridges to cross. And so the river is actually a geographically important landmark. Finally, in the upper right is the sort of state of the war as of last week, where Russia controls about a little bit less than 20% of the territory of Ukraine, and it's mostly in the eastern side. The area at the bottom, Crimea, and the areas of Donetsk and Luhansk are areas, the so-called Donbass region. That's areas that Russia invaded in 2014, Crimea, and there's been ongoing war in that Donbass region since 2014. So in some ways, the current war is not territorially that different from 2014, but the intensity is much different. And the if you haven't been following carefully, but initially Russia tried to invade Kiev, right, in the middle center, the capital of Ukraine. And Ukrainians have pushed them back. So the goals of the war have been scaled back dramatically on the Ukrainian side. But I think it's important just to start with the map to understand that we're dealing with a very large country, 144 million people in Ukraine as well. Okay, next slide. Oh, it's funny. I'm looking at my screen and I think it didn't change. Okay. It's a little bit funny doing it back and forth. Okay. Anyways, the key question that people have is, why did Putin decide on February 24th to invade Ukraine? And I want to talk about these three background factors before talking about the miscalculation overall. So one of the things that comes up frequently is the role of NATO and the 1990s, and whether the NATO expansion caused Putin to feel insecure and therefore caused the war. And I want to give a longish answer that essentially is a no to that interpretation. The 1990s are really important, but they're symbolically important for Russia because this is a time, the Soviet Union broke up in 1991. There were 15 countries of the former Soviet Union that broke up into different independent states. Russia is one of them. Ukraine is one of them. The Baltic states are three of them. Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus are the ones actually that signed the initial agreement leaving the Soviet Union. When Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus left the Soviet Union, that was the end of the Soviet Union. There's no Soviet Union essentially without Russia. So, and that was under Boris Yeltsin. But what followed was a period of real economic turmoil for Russia, a lot of political instability, although democracy as well. But the period of the 90s by a lot of Russians is considered this chaotic period where Russia was weakened. And many Russians believe that there was an agreement that if Germany were allowed to reunify, then NATO would not expand. Now, many people in the U.S. absolutely deny that was the case. U.S. policy people say that we never had such an agreement. Nevertheless, that is what a lot of Russians think. And hence, they think NATO expansion was kind of a trickery, double-crossing of this agreement. And so they're mad about it. And they also understand they were powerless to do anything about NATO expansion. So the important aspect of NATO expansion is not that NATO posed a military threat to Russia, which it doesn't, as an offensive military threat. The important thing is that NATO expansion is a symbol of the weakness of Russia. It's something Russia didn't want, and they got it anyways, especially initially with the three Baltic states joining. But the idea of Georgia or other former Soviet states joining NATO is also very much disliked by many Russians and by Putin. But the important piece here is that NATO per se was not threatening Russia, but that NATO expansion is kind of a symbol of this humiliation. A second piece of this, but that doesn't mean a humiliation leads to a genocidal war. I just want to be clear. People can be humiliated. It doesn't mean they become murderers. So that experience of humiliation, while we can acknowledge that maybe that's how some people feel, that's not a justification for a war. The second thing is that Ukraine is sort of special among the former Soviet states because Ukraine, number one, had two successful social revolutions in 2014 and in 2004, both times kicking out a pro-Russian politician, actually the same person, Viktor Yanukovych. And so this is not something Putin wants to see, a successful rising up of the people to kick out a pro-Russian politician. And Ukraine has made it clear a number of times that they are orienting themselves towards the West rather than towards Russia, towards democracy rather than authoritarianism. And these are things that are threatening to Putin as he holds on to Russia in an authoritarian, anti-Western way. Another, I think, critical piece of this, though, is that from the Russian side, there is a total denial of the nationhood and sovereignty and the legitimacy of the sovereignty of Ukraine as a Soviet, former Soviet state and the other former Soviet states. So for the 15 former Soviet republics, as long as they do what Putin wants and they side with him on various things and they take an anti-Western, anti-NATO stand, then they're fine as states. But once they stand up to him, that's when he puts pressure in various ways. And actually, we're seeing this not only in Ukraine, but also right now in Kazakhstan. The Kazakh president has criticized the war, and Russia is now trying to cut off gas pipelines from Kazakh gas going through Russia. So the denial of sovereignty of the former Soviet states, I think, at this point is pretty clear. People talk about colonialism, imperialism by Russia, et cetera. And there is some of that, too, in terms of not taking seriously Ukrainian nationhood, not understanding many important pieces about Ukraine, including a famine in 1932-33 that most Ukrainians consider a genocide, the widespread destruction in Ukraine during World War II that's very relevant for people in Ukraine. From the Russian perspective, this is not that important. It's not something they cared about. And so there's a kind of dismissal of Ukrainian claims of nationhood, as these are our sort of our country cousins or some kind of derogatory understanding of they're sort of like us, but a little bit different, and we're a bit better than them. One thing that's kind of puzzling, though, on that slide, can you move it up a little bit because it's a little bit too big? Oops, I guess not. Okay, anyways, I'll just tell you. My last point, that's okay, on the identity factors is that there's not a level of mass ethnic hatred between Ukrainians and Russians in Russia. So if you went to Russia up until February 24th, there's 10 million Russians that have direct relatives in Ukraine. Ukrainians are the largest non-Russian minority in the country. Many people are of mixed Ukrainian ethnic, Russian-Ukrainian heritage. So this is not a situation like Palestinians and Jews in West Bank or something where there's this like long-term animosity between these groups. There is more and more today since the war started, especially on the Ukrainian side, an anti-Russian sentiment because they're being, you know, attacked by Russians. But something that I think is important to note is this isn't a situation where everybody in Russia understands, oh yes, we hate Ukrainians. It just was not, people were unprepared actually for this war in that sense. Okay, next slide. Okay, but the big issue is, in addition to these background factors, there's just a level of miscalculation by Putin on what would happen if they were to invade. This picture is of Putin meeting with his economic advisors right after the war happened. And this phenomenon of the long table is actually not, that didn't occur before the war in Russia. This is something started since the war. Putin kind of came out of hibernation and now meets with people in these long tables. People think it's both due to COVID worries as well as assassination attempts, that he doesn't want anybody to be physically close to him. But it's also a symbol of his isolation, that he is not, those are his advisors that he's supposedly conferring with. Okay, so how did he miscalculate? Number one, he thought Ukrainians would not resist. The Russian soldiers literally brought with them dress uniforms because they thought their three-day operation would end with Ukrainians greeting them with flowers as liberators. And this is partly because of this denial of Ukrainian nationhood and not paying attention to people in Ukraine, their actual thoughts, feelings, and the fact that since 2014, people in Ukraine have essentially been preparing for a larger war because they believed that Russia was going to invade again. So the idea that Ukrainians would not resist is just totally ignorant, and not, this is not a top secret thing. This is something that if you looked at any public opinion polls, newspapers, articles, etc. in Ukraine, you would have seen that there is absolutely zero interest in Ukraine for being part of Russia. Second aspect of Putin's miscalculation is his previous military victories, starting with the 10-year war in Chechnya that started, sorry, that's a typo, it should be 2009. From 2000 to 2009, Putin fought a very brutal war in Chechnya. A lot of human rights abuses, a lot of atrocities, and he more or less got away with it, which I can talk about reasons why. Georgia, 2008, Crimea, the invasion in 2014, and Syria, again, targeting civilians, atrocities, and basically he faced little punishment for that. He expected sanctions to be weak based on the 2014 experience, but instead sanctions have been unprecedented in scope and scale and speed. Putin expected the United States to be divided. As you all know, we live in a very polarized country between Democrats and Republicans. But if you listen to Democrat and Republican senators or congresspeople, there is basically no difference in their opinion in terms of support for Ukraine in this war. And I think that's a very important aspect of the war in terms of Ukraine's international support and something Putin did not count on. He expected that Europe would not care. Remember, Brexit just happened. But Europe has become more united in this. NATO has become more united in this. The U.S. working with NATO and European allies is stronger than ever. So actually, there's an incredible unity in the world to support Ukraine that I think Putin did not bank on. And also, the last point is about media attention. A lot of people in Russia, and including Putin, I think, they control the media environment in Russia 100% of TV and newspapers. Not so much the internet, although they have some control over the internet, but you can still get news on the internet. But in terms of TV, which is where a lot of people get their news, they have total control. And so they kind of look, they present a picture of what's happening in the war, which is that they're winning. There are no atrocities. Any pictures of atrocities are fake, or if they were real, the Ukrainians killed themselves. So they present this message over and over, and they are unaware that the rest of the world is watching what's happening and largely coming to the side and aid of Ukraine because of what's happening. So I think that their media environment is actually counterproductive for them in the sense that they don't understand the way the rest of the world has reacted to the war. Okay, next slide. Okay, so another thing I want to just focus on a little bit, this is actually one of the main areas of my research is on studying nationalism, national identity, is that why was Ukraine able to put up such a resistance? And let me say, if you talk to me before the war, and if you look back at my interviews, I did not think Russia would invade. And I didn't think they would invade because, number one, I thought they would lose. I thought every Ukrainian is going to fight this until the end, and there's no way Russia is going to take over the country. And second, I thought this is a ruination of Russia. It's just going to totally destroy the economy and political system in Russia. And it just is a crazy thing to do. And I was wrong, however, in terms of the decision to invade, but not wrong on the consequences, and that Ukrainians have stepped up to fight. Why did people think Ukrainians wouldn't? Well, there have been really significant disagreements in Ukraine over national identity issues in the past. Russian speakers versus Ukrainian speakers, ethnic Russians, Ukrainian Russians. Ukraine is a site for some of the worst massacres of Jews in the Holocaust. So there are significant ethnic, religious, linguistic differences. However, there has been a lot of progress in building an inclusive sense of national identity in Ukraine since the end of the Soviet Union, and especially since 2014, and nothing signifies that more than Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine. He is Jewish, Russian speaker from the East, who came to the presidency with massive support from Western nationalist Ukrainians, in Ukrainian speakers, ethnic Ukrainians. So I think if people just looked at his election, you would see that this is not a divided country in the old ways that people think about it. In fact, there's a different sense of what it means to be Ukrainian, which is much more inclusive. And there's a unity among elites and people in Ukraine of supporting their state. I think a lot of people in Ukraine after 2014 realized that they need to wake up and get ready, because in 2014, when Russia invaded, there were a lot of defections. The head of the Ukrainian Navy switched sides, joined the Russian Navy, took ships with him. But a lot of those defections in 2014 meant that people who were pro-Russian already switched sides in 2014. And so who's left are people who are very committed to a Ukrainian state and preserving the Ukrainian nation. And this leads to a unity in motivation and will and commitment. And something I think is really important is that Russia banked on collaborators. They thought they could pay off regional oligarchs or different politicians, and that Zelensky would just go to Dubai or leave the country or something, and that people would just say, okay, if you're giving us money, we'll just join your side. That turned out to be completely wrong, and I think one of the key reasons why this collaboration strategy didn't work is because of this inclusive sense of national identity and commitment to the state that you see in Ukraine today. Okay, next slide. Okay, so what is next? So, as I said, I think there's going to continue to be united support within Ukraine for defending Ukraine. And that's going to mean in the places where the Russians are not, Ukrainians are working together. In the in places that Russians have taken over, that's going to mean insurgency. Russia, unfortunately, is committed to using not just more violence, but a strategy of cruelty and punishment, targeting civilians and trying to break the will of Ukrainians by punishment. So not just strategic war goals of targeting military places, but making people feel like this war is too costly and they need to just give up. So the Russian strategy is more violence, but on the other hand, Ukrainians have received more and more international military support. And I think in the end, I don't think there's any doubt that Ukraine is going to prevail. I think now with the association with the EU agreement, it's likely to join the EU. But it's going to be very, very costly for Ukraine. I was just chatting with Aaron earlier about your renovation here, your beautiful renovation of Prairie. And something I like to tell people is think about this. You're living your life in your apartment or your house or something, or you have a school or a church or something, and you have to flee because of Russian artillery. That artillery destroys something, your apartment, your building, etc. Where do people get the money to rebuild? Even if you had to renovate your bathroom, even if you did, think of the scale of destruction that Russia is bringing to Ukraine economically, not to mention in terms of the human tragedy and all the rebuilding that that is going to take. It's just massively costly for Ukrainians, but I think that they're going to be committed to doing that rebuilding, but it's just, it's just incredibly... It's such a terrible price that Ukrainians are having to pay essentially for nothing, for a completely pointless war. On the Russian side, Putin will not stop voluntarily. He will not change his mind. He will not retire. He will not see the light. He will not say, I'm sorry. There is no redemption of Vladimir Putin. He is committed to committing every atrocity, killing every person. He's similar to Assad in Syria, to Lukashenko in Belarus. But he has nevertheless been deterred in some of his goals. He wanted to take over the whole country. That's clearly not possible. He's still committed to punishing Ukraine, to taking as much territory as they can in the east, but it's going to be a military defeat that is stopping him, not any kind of convincing talking, etc., because he's a fundamentally untrustworthy and malevolent person. Putin has already cracked down very much on any kind of dissent in Russia, so I think elite or mass protests are not likely there just because of the context of fear. I just want to note this. So these pictures, the upper left is, those are Ukrainian protesters in the city of Kherson. That's in the south. It's a very important city on the Black Sea. It's at the mouth of that Dnieper River, and so it's a really important strategic city. It had been controlled by Russians, and there were Ukrainian protests. Those are Ukrainian protests in Kherson, and Ukraine is really, Kherson is an important city right now. The other picture is that maternity hospital in Mariupol early in the war. That was one of the first signs of the atrocities and war crimes committed by Russia. But down below is, this is a picture of a Russian TV newscast with a protester, so-called protester, who had been a TV newscaster also on a Russian-controlled TV. So she comes on the TV with this no war sign. Then she leaves the country and goes to Germany and gets a job with Die Welt. But there's a lot of fishy aspects to this. Like, why was she allowed on TV? How come she's a pro-Putin person up until this moment? What about her? Now she has this job in Germany. Well, she was just fired by Die Welt. People think she was some kind of spy in terms of having a Russian person working there. And now Die Welt has been banned in Russia. So it shows the complexity of protest. This is what is it? Was it a psychological operation by Russia? Was it real dissent? We don't really know. But it's very fishy. But anyways, many people there are thinking, there's a lot of support in Russia for the war, but there are a lot of people who don't support the war, and those people are very constrained in what they can do because opposition people have been put in jail, people are being tortured, they lose a lot by protesting, so it's a very difficult situation if you're not a supporter of Putin. I think the sanctions are degrading Russia's long-term state capacity and their ability to wage war, but unfortunately they are taking time. But I think that this is going to result in very serious long-term damage to Russia for decades. And just the last image there was of the ruble. People look at the ruble rate, that's the Russian currency, and how it's gone down. Now you can see in the news it's gone up. But why it's gone up is because it's no longer a convertible currency, because there's so many restrictions on changing euros or dollars into the ruble. That was a major achievement of Russia, to achieve a convertible stable currency since the end of the Soviet Union. And that's, as my economist friend said, that's been flushed down the toilet. There's just no more ruble currency. Okay, last slide is just what we can do. So these are just pictures of Madison. This is the Overture Center right after the war. You see an American and Ukrainian flag on the stage. I wanted to say for myself, this is very unusual. No matter what international events we've had, you just do not see American flags with another flag pretty much anywhere. And you see that all over. I saw that in Chicago for the 4th of July. I was in Lake Placid in March, which is very America, Olympic town. It had lots of Ukrainian flags on the street. It's just an incredible phenomenon to see Ukrainian flags alongside American flags. This was a rally at the Capitol, and this is the airport just last month. Okay, as I mentioned, it's there's bipartisan support for Ukraine, and I think it is worthwhile to number one, why I give lots of these talks like this is I think it's important for people to understand what's happening, to understand the need to support Ukraine. And people can do that on a small scale by just talking to their friends and families. I mean, luckily, this is a very, there's a lot of bipartisan support, so you don't have to worry about getting in terrible disagreements with most people when you talk about it. But just educating people and talking to people, I think, is a way to help people understand why it's important for the United States to continue to support Ukraine. I think it's also important to keep up support with our Congressman Mark Pocan, with our Senators Tammy Baldwin and Ron Johnson, because we want a united United States in favor of supporting Ukraine. There's a lot of aid agencies, if people are interested in giving giving money to humanitarian agencies, and you can find those. I have the website for the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia there. There are organizations listed there, or pretty much every media, like a news station, like local news stations, they also list agencies for giving money. So it's easy to find a reputable agency if you're interested. But most important, I think, is just for people to think about their values, think about democracy, think about all the words in these lovely songs that and poems that have been shared today, to think about how to do that is to think about being on the right side of these kinds of conflicts and supporting humanitarianism, supporting peace and democracy in places. So I want to just leave you with that. And now I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you. Sure.
You showed Chechnya.
What's
Chechnya
that?
Brought the war home to Russia eventually. When will Ukrainians start doing terrorist activities in Moscow? These are people who could easily pass through borders and get to places.
Yeah. Hello? Yeah. I'm wondering when, I said Chechnya was brought to Russia after when they had done their terrible violence to them. All of a sudden, you may remember the day when the Chechnyans took 300 children from a school and killed many of them, or most of them. It was a terrible tragedy, but what it did was it shook up Russia, as far as I can tell. And I'm wondering where the Ukrainian terrorists will show up in Moscow. I'm just wondering.
Yeah, I've actually written an article comparing the Chechen wars with this war. Chechnya is 35 times smaller than Ukraine. And the Chechens were very committed also to some level of sovereignty. But after two wars and 9 years of just being bombed to smithereens, Chechens resorted to terrorism. The Beslan massacre that you mentioned was in a school. Chechens actually took the school hostage, but it was the Russians who went in and killed everybody in the school. So blaming it on the Chechens. But this is, actually, there's many aspects of Putin's behavior that are similar to this, that there's a hostage taking at a school, they kill everybody in the school, and they just say, you know, well, that's how it goes. I mean, just a horrific situation. I don't think Ukrainians will learn the lesson from that war that terrorism is an effective strategy, especially when they have international support for weapons and things like that. I think that they understand the media environment very well, and they understand that terrorism is likely to turn the tide against them. So I think terrorism on the part of Chechens is really a strategy of absolute desperation. So I don't think that is likely. But Ukrainians are making inroads into bombing places along the border in Russia. And so I think that some cities along the border in Russia may see some military action, conflict. But I don't think Ukrainians will resort to terrorism. I think you just hold it close to you.
Hi, Gene Kane. Sometime when the war first started, Putin gave a warning that any resistance, massive resistance, particularly if any Western nations got involved, that the West would be punished in a way that they have never seen before. And that, to me, was an implication he would be ready to use at least tactical atomic weapons, not in the West necessarily, but he could use them in the Ukraine, at least as a symbol that he means business to achieve his goals. And I wonder how you feel about that.
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, something I've thought about a lot. Actually, my husband works on international relations and nuclear weapons, and so we actually have discussed this question at length over the last few months. So one thing I'll say is that Putin has made various threats, and I think you're exactly right that that was a veiled nuclear threat. But whereas the Russians were very unaware and, say, ignorant of the situation in Ukraine, they are absolutely on top of nuclear weapons in terms of who has what capabilities are, what counterstrike capabilities are, because nuclear weapons and arms talks and things like that put Russia on the same level as the United States. So they love arms control negotiations because it means there's two important countries in the world. And they are totally aware but also irritated that the U.S. unilaterally under George W. Bush cut off a lot of arms negotiation talks because they thought that was humiliating. So they're very aware of capabilities. And they are very aware of our counterstrike capabilities are much stronger than theirs. And they know exactly what NATO can do, what NATO is up to. So I don't think they would stumble into a nuclear exchange out of ignorance. I think it's a little bit of a different scenario than what they got into in Ukraine. But in terms of the use of tactical nuclear weapons, I think that they recognize very clearly that this would be a serious red line. They have not engaged NATO, even though they could have, because NATO is supplying Ukraine. They have hardly used their air force. It's another puzzle of the war. So I think that that is saber-rattling, meant to deter the U.S. and NATO from supplying Ukraine, but that they're not actually serious about that. However, on the U.S. side, we do take the idea of a NATO-Russian war extremely seriously, and I think that's the reason why, unfortunately, we're seeing all this. NATO, if NATO had been formally involved initially from the start, the war would have ended much quicker. So many people, that's what they wanted initially, a no-fly zone and things like that. But the U.S. takes the possibility of a NATO-Russian nuclear exchange extremely seriously, and for that reason has done everything it can to not allow NATO to be directly involved, but to support Ukraine in some other way, which has led to criticism by some. But I think people take the issue very seriously, but I don't think the Russians are actually serious about using nuclear weapons.
Hi, I'm Richard, and I'd like to ask about food insecurity worldwide. You know, it was amazing to see the John Deere tractors on the TV in Ukraine, and I understand the Russian foreign minister just walked out of the G20 when food insecurity was on the agenda. Could you talk about, because this thing's going to go on for a long time, and this is having a worldwide impact. Could you illustrate that a little bit?
Sure. And let me just recognize your Miracle League T-shirt, big supporter of Miracle League umpire. Here in Madison. It's a great organization. Okay, food insecurity. Ukraine and Russia collectively supply a lot of grain. I think it's like 30% of the world's wheat. Russia supplies fertilizer and things like that. A lot of that grain goes to countries in North Africa and the Middle East. So the disruption of Ukrainian grain supplies out of the Black Sea is leading, like people know, for other reasons, prices are up on different commodities. So that's adding to the increase in prices, this decline in supply. It's a little bit of a game of chicken in that Russians could allow that grain to leave, but they want to use this as leverage. Ukrainians actually have mined a lot of ports along the Black Sea to protect their southern border there. So it's not a matter of just sending in ships. Those areas would have to be demined. If you demine them, then that allows Russians to go in. Again, going back to the previous question of a NATO or U.S. Confrontation with Russia, everyone wants to avoid that. I was at an event last month with Senator Rob Portman, Republican, and Jeanne Shaheen, Democrat. Jeanne Shaheen surprised me by saying, like, we need to call the Russians bluff on the Black Sea in this grain issue and just send our ships in. Okay, well, people remember the Lusitania, things like that. Like, what if you send in a ship that's protected by U.S. or NATO? I mean, it's just a complicated thing. First of all, there's the there's Turkey, there's the Bosphorus. You can't just send in a ship. That means you have to have military ships going through, getting Turkey's approval. Turkey already doesn't allow Russian ships out or other military ships in. So it's a very complicated place to just send in ships, and it's risky. So right now, there's kind of a stalemate of Ukrainian grain cannot get out. The West and the world is looking at this increasing prices and wondering what to do. Russians have taken some of it and are trying to sell it themselves. I personally think let the Russians take it out and sell it and just add it to the bill in terms of war reparations for Russia. I mean, it's fine. It doesn't seem like a big deal if Russians are selling the grain. You can easily keep track of that. So I think that the longer this goes on, the more there's a chance of continued disruptions to wheat and other grains, but also other like things like cooking oil and things like that. But in addition, the Ukrainian famine under Stalin in 1932-33 happened because it happened over grain requisition, that the Soviets took this grain and not only took the existing grain, but they took the seed grain. And there's a back and forth of whether that was actual seed grain or not, but they took this seed grain and they caused this massive famine because there was nothing to plant the next year. Every Ukrainian knows this story. And so the idea of the grain, it's a very touchy thing of like, right now, what's happening? What's going to happen next year? How are they going to plant? So that's why there's a need to end the war as soon as possible and return to that. But I think it's unlikely the war is going to end before at least the next few months. And so I think, unfortunately, the food issues are going to continue to be a problem. I mean, the food, not and just in terms of global economy, there's the food issues, and there's also the energy disruptions to Europe. Russia supplies 30% of Europe's energy, and everybody sees gas prices here. It's like even worse in Europe, and it's going to get worse as the fall goes on. But the worse Russia behaves, the less Europeans are willing to put up with it, and the more they are going to move towards doing anything to avoid relying on Russia, including probably a return to nuclear or some other kinds of things that seemed off the table even just a few months ago.
We have time for one more question. So I saw a hand over here, and then we have to move on with the service.
Yeah, I'm wondering about how this all relates back to Trump and Zelensky, and it ended up in an impeachment. But what was, in your opinion, what was going on there, and does this have anything to do with Russia's current actions?
Yeah, it's a good question, and everybody wants to know, like, what would have happened if Trump was president? What explains the timing of the invasion? So remember, the first Trump impeachment was because the U.S. Congress had allocated money and weapon systems for Ukraine that Ukraine really wanted. Now, Ukraine kind of talked about those in desperate terms, and back then it seemed like, well, why are they so, like, why is it such a big deal for Ukraine? And the reason was the Ukrainians were fearing this kind of attack. And remember, the reason for the first Trump impeachment was that Trump had told Zelensky, I'm not going to allocate these weapon systems and this money to your country unless you produce some kind of negative stories on Biden for the election. So that was impeachment number one. Trump, in rhetoric, is, you know, a lover of dictatorship, right? In his words, he loves Kim Jong-un, he loves Assad, he loves Putin. You know, he talks of, right after the invasion, he talked about Putin being a genius, etc. But in actions, because Trump was so pro-Russian, remember Michael Flynn, the national security advisor, who's essentially a traitor to the United States, dealing with the Russians. Because of this untrustworthy behavior of Trump, the U.S. Congress, in a bipartisan way, constrained Trump by putting the sanctions, for example, the Russian sanctions, into law rather than just executive action. And Trump never went against those things. So if you look at the actual actions of the United States under Trump versus under his predecessors, it's not actually that much pro-Russian compared to, say, Obama. But rhetorically, Trump is definitely a supporter of Putin. From the Russian side, they say, okay, Trump, he says he likes us. He said he was going to get rid of the sanctions, but he's completely screwed everything up. Instead of getting rid of the sanctions are now basically permanent in law. And, you know, he said he was going to cut off supplies to Zelensky, but he didn't. He just, you know, made these threats, and, like, he's just basically messed everything up. So the Russians see him as totally unreliable in terms of delivering on actual support. And support would mean getting rid of sanctions and stopping the supply of weapons to Ukraine. And Trump did not do any of those things. Not because he didn't want to, but just because he was kind of constrained by Congress and he didn't care enough about it, I think, to do anything. So from the Russian point of view, what's happening is, even though they don't like the Biden administration, they see that Biden is actually more pro-Ukrainian, and Ukraine is getting more and more weapons from the U.S., and so they could have waited until they thought there would be a new Trump administration, when they would not have, if Trump is in office, if he had been in office, if he comes back to office, that unity of the U.S., NATO, et cetera, goes out the window. So it would have been advantageous for Putin to wait for Trump to come back into power in order to not have a united U.S., NATO, European front. But there was a danger because Ukraine was getting stronger in various ways, military, economically. And so I think one of the calculations was they thought they needed to act before Ukraine was further strengthened. Plus, there's a lot of things about energy, including the ramping up of U.S. LNG, shale oil production, and things like that as a possible alternative to Russia. So there's various reasons why it might have made sense now. But I think the important thing is that the U.S., NATO, U.S., European unity is absolutely vital to this war, and that is almost certainly going to be destroyed by a second Trump administration, because Trump remains incredibly anti-NATO, anti-European. All right. Thank you so much.
Yes, thanks so much for that presentation and very interesting discussion. So now we are going to move on to the offertory. We're sharing our offering this quarter with Wilma's Fund, which provides assessments and assistance to the LGBTQ plus people who are experiencing homelessness, as well as support to prevent homelessness in this population. The offertory is Meditation from Thais, I'm not sure about the pronunciation, by Massenet, performed by Amber. All right. Thanks, Amber, and thanks, everyone. Closing words will be read by Evelyn Kane.
Evelyn Kane, she, her, hers. The closing words are by Katerina Kalitko, poet, translator, author, and member of PEN Ukraine. War does not abolish the power of tenderness and love.
All right, and the closing music is Filled with Loving Kindness, number 1031 in this book, not the same one as before. All right, we had some technical difficulties with Zoom, so I don't know if we were recording earlier, okay, but anyhow, we are going to stop the recording at this point.